parsing out Snowden's legal options today, Monday, November 4th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A letter from NSA leaker Edward Snowden prompts a debate about clemency. We hear what his real legal options are going forward.
I have no doubt that if he did return, that there'd be a whole host constellation of very brilliant lawyers available and eager to defend him.
Also today, the father of a Russian-American Greenpeace activist worries about his son's fate in a Russian prison. He should know, he served time in one too. Plus, Andy Warhol's trip to visit the Empress of Iran back in 1976.
When he got back to the hotel, I kept asking him, well, what was she like? What was the palace like? And he kept saying, oh, she's so great. Oh, the palace was so beautiful. She's so great. The palace was so beautiful. I finally realized he was afraid his hotel room was bugged.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If NSA leaker Edward Snowden was looking for clemency, it doesn't look like he's getting any. Both White House and congressional officials are rejecting the notion. Some thought Snowden was asking for clemency in a letter he wrote to a member of Germany's parliament in which he stated, "Speaking the truth is not a crime." Bruce Fein was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He was also, until recently, the lawyer representing Edward Snowden's father, Lon Snowden. Bruce, what do you make of this letter? Are you one of those who saw it as a plea for clemency?
I don't think so. That's a stretch, but it's very unclear, given the lack of direct access to Mr. Snowden. Who is an intermediary? Did he write the letter? Did somebody else write the letter? And so it leaves open to speculation exactly the bona fides of any such statement, given the fog in which he's enshrouded.
Right. So just lay it out for us. What is Snowden's legal situation as far as ever coming back to the U.S. is concerned?
I think that, number one, there are several options that could happen. The president could just unilaterally decide that since Edward Snowden stimulated the national conversation that he said was urgent, therefore as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, even though he's also disclosed, in fact, even more interceptions of foreigners who have no protection under the Fourth Amendment and by no stretch of the legal imagination could be illegal, that he would nevertheless decide that he would drop the prosecution. Then you have an option. He could try to seek asylum elsewhere than in Russia. When Mr. Snowden was in Hong Kong with Glenn Greenwald, he was quite explicit that he wanted asylum in a place like Iceland that protected and honored human rights, freedom of speech, freedom of association, and whatever else you can say about Russia and Vladimir Putin. They do not honor freedom of speech, freedom of dissent, any of the things that Ed said that he stands for. Indeed, Mr. Putin really locks up everybody who voices a dissent from his decrees and his desire to maintain limitless power. Now, there is another option. It's one that I would encourage Ed to consider, and that is to seek to obtain assurances through a lawyer in the United States that if he returned, he would be protected fully by the Constitution of the United States. He'd have an impartial venue, that he would not be treated like Bradley or Chelsea Manning before trial. He'd have a fair opportunity to present his case and have access to his lawyers, basically not pretrial detention like Daniel Ellsberg, charged with the same Espionage Act violations, was not detained prior to trial, but basically come back and make his case to the American people. Indeed, that is what Edward Snowden said his decision to make these disclosures was all about. And I do believe that staying in Russia under the thumb of Mr. Putin really distracts attention from the goal that Edward Snowden himself said was the mission of his particular endeavor.
I got to say, Bruce Fein, there's a very different feel to the Edward Snowden saga now since when it all began back in May. I mean, the story has moved well beyond the U.S. spying on its citizens. How do you see the changes in the story since it began?
Well, I agree with you, and it shows, I suppose, a question of judgment about Mr. Snowden and those who are publicizing initially, you know, the wrongdoing, which was focused on spying on American citizens protected by the Fourth Amendment, protected by our Patriot Act, keeping this secret from Americans who have a right to know what their government is doing in order to change the law. And now it's just sort of sprawling into, you know, just any kind of spying is bad. And the whole, you know, preoccupation now is these melodrama cell phone of Angela Merkel or the president of Brazil or the things that are really trivial, if not irrelevant, to the rule of law in the United States. And they now capture the headlines, which in my judgment is most unfortunate. It shows a gross misconception of what the evils were that Mr. Snowden was disclosing in part.
Bruce Fine, Deputy Assistant Attorney General during the Reagan administration, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
While Russia is giving refuge to one fugitive American, it's holding two other U.S. citizens who were part of a Greenpeace protest against oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean. A total of 30 Greenpeace activists were arrested last September after Russian authorities seized their ship. The group is still in jail and facing hooliganism charges, which carry a possible 7-year prison sentence. One of those being held is Dima Litvinov. His father, Pavel Litvinov, is no stranger to Russian prisons. He's a former Soviet dissident, now a retired math teacher living in the U.S. It's got to be difficult as a father to know your son is sitting in a Russian jail. What do you hear and know about Dima? Are you still even able to speak with him?
Well, what I know is that he is still in prison in Murmansk. The prison is cold. Occasionally he sees his lawyer. Twice he spoke to his wife. What worries me is that he is 51 years old. So twice of my age when I was in a Russian prison, and this is a late age to start prison career. If there is a good age, I don't know, but at least it worries me. But he is still pretty strong, and I hope that being morally strong, he will keep his health, but I'm very worried.
What do you know about the reputation of this Murmansk prison? Did you ever serve time there?
No, I didn't serve time there. But it's not the worst and not the best, but it's very cold. It's very far north. The conditions there are definitely worse than in Moscow and other places, but I don't know any details.
Your son Dima had been an interpreter on earlier Greenpeace actions in Russia. He must have known the risks he was taking.
Well, yes, of course he knew the risks. He was ready. He was dedicated to the cause of ecology and environment and loved the Arctic. But he didn't expect that it would happen that way, that he would be accused in piracy. So he kind of knew, but expected it not to happen. And he wrote to me that he didn't expect that the life in and what he saw in prisons and what happened to them is not that different from what he heard from me and other people, his grandfather, about Stalinist camps.
So your son is now the third generation of Litvinovs in your family who've been arrested by Soviet and Russian authorities for political reasons. Why the dissent? And what is it about your family that you just won't accept the status quo?
Yes, it's a good question. His grandfather, he was a Russian communist. And during the World War II, he was fighting Germans. And when the Russian army entered Germany, it started to loot and rape and kill peaceful population, and he couldn't stand it. And he started to speak up and criticize his own army bosses, and he was sentenced to 10 years of labor camps. So that's first generation. With me, I just loved Russian literature, Russian culture, and decided to speak for freedom of speech, especially when the Soviets sent troops into Czechoslovakia in 1968 to stop freedom of speech in Czechoslovakia. They didn't call it that way, but that was the way it was. And I was arrested, beaten, brought to prison in Moscow, and then sent to exile and hard labor in Siberia.
In your letter to the Washington Post, you kind of end with a question. Is it not the time to break the cycle? Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that the third generation is arrested, and Dima is now under threat to go to labor camp like his grandfather and me went. And I believe that Russia has to change. And there was a hope after Perestroika, after Gorbachev, that the things will change. And the Dima's arrest kind of signals that the change is not deep, and Russia is going again to authoritarian state and becomes worse and worse, but I still hope. And I just want to use Dima's example to show is Russia should stop and join civilized world.
Pavel Litvinov is a former Soviet dissident now living in the U.S. Now it's his son Dima who's in jail in Russia. Greatly appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Marko.
Our next story is also about someone who was born in Russia but grew up in the United States. Tatiana McFadden made history this weekend. She won the New York City Marathon's women's wheelchair race. She also won the event earlier this year in Boston, London, and Chicago. So her win in New York completed an unprecedented grand slam of the world's major marathons. Tatiana, congratulations. You've done what no one else ever has.
Thank you.
So was it a close finish, or were you out in front all the way?
No, I was out front all the way. I dropped the pack from the first hill, and the only female athlete who was able to catch me was Wakako from Japan. She caught me on the bottom of the downhill, and so she stayed with me until about mile four, until I hit that climb hard. And then for the rest of the way, I was by myself for the entire race.
I mean, you've really come a long way to win these four events, London, Boston, Chicago, and now New York. Has it settled in yet?
A little bit. I mean, I've been running around doing things, but I think it's going to settle in more later this week. You know, it's just been a phenomenal experience with the amount of support that I'm getting from the community, from the media. You know, it just, you know, I've put such hard work into this. I was so incredibly happy with the win because I just wanted to close out the season with that. And it's just been absolutely phenomenal.
I hinted earlier at your background, born in Russia but grew up in the United States. You were adopted, and after you won the 2010 New York City Marathon, you flew to your former orphanage in Russia and gave the director your medal. What does that orphanage symbolize for you?
It's just, it's about going back and just showing your appreciation because no one's gone back and told them what a success story I was. So, you know, that experience for me was fulfilling. I really need to go back because, you know, that's where my roots are. I was born there and lived there for 6 years. So it was really important for me to go back.
You're a busy woman. You're training also right now for Sochi and the Russian Winter Olympics in cross-country skiing. What is that homecoming going to be like?
So I'm trying out for cross-country skiing for Sochi. So the events will be the sprint, the 5K, and the 10K. So the qualifications are in December in Canada. And then we'll find out who makes the team for cross-country skiing in January. And then the games will happen in March. So it's all happening pretty fast. But, you know, like the training from the marathons will really carry over into the cross-country skiing because you need the strength and endurance. So the training for the marathons and all my track events will really help for Sochi.
And Tatiana, what does Russia mean to you?
You know, it's just, it's where my roots are. And so, I mean, I'm never going to forget where I was born and raised, but I live my life in America. So going back to Sochi, you know, it's about showing that, you know, people with disabilities, you know, can live a normal life and can be phenomenal elite athletes just like anybody else. And it's about showing, you know, the public eye, you know, a living success story. And that's what it's really all about.
What next? Are you going to take a couple of days off or it's just straight back into training?
Well, actually, I'm heading back right now because I have exams all this week. So I'll probably take off this week and then start training towards the end of the week and gear up. Yeah.
Tatiana McFadden, winner of the women's wheelchair race in the New York City Marathon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Still to come on The World, Campbell's Soup, Brillo, and the Empress of Iran. We'll explain later. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS. And by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. High tension in Egypt again as the trial of deposed President Mohamed Morsi got underway in Cairo. Muslim Brotherhood supporters protested outside as Morsi appeared for the first time since he was ousted by the military last July. He and other Islamist officials are facing charges of inciting the killing of protesters last year. Morsi rejected the court's authority, though. He also insisted he's still the country's legitimate president and refused to wear the uniform required of defendants. In the end, the judge adjourned the trial until January. Khaled Daoud is a spokesman for Egypt's Constitution Party. It opposed Morsi's rule, but now supports a democratic solution to the country's troubles. Daoud wasn't surprised by what happened in court today.
Since Morsi was ousted nearly 4 months ago, he's been insisting that this has been an illegal decision. His followers have been demonstrating in the street. There was a very high state of security alert. There were nearly no people in the streets, mostly armored vehicles and army and security people. They were expecting far bigger demonstrations. The streets seemed to be rather back to normal, except for a few skirmishes here and there.
Mr. Daoud, I mean, given the defiance of Morsi and his followers in court today, do you think it was a propaganda victory for the Muslim Brotherhood?
They will try to play it like this. But at the end of the day, you know, despite all Morsi's claims and allegations, he did accept the trial because now he has a lawyer. And whether the defendant, in that case, former President Morsi, recognizes the court or not, the procedures will go on.
The trial is now delayed until January. Do you think the military still has the upper hand?
The military has been in control of the situation in Egypt since 1952. The military has never been a trivial force in Egypt. It always had to be considered when you're thinking of Egyptian politics. And again, you know, the army intervened on June 30 to fulfill the wishes of millions of Egyptians who were not happy with Morsi's and the Muslim Brotherhood rule. So a lot of Egyptians would not agree to describe that it's a military coup or that the country now is being controlled by the military. The military has a very influential, very important role. No one can doubt that. But there are others who took part in the revolution against Mubarak, like my party. We're also part of the government, and we're hoping to rewrite a new constitution and to agree on a new parliament and a new president, hopefully soon, probably by the middle of next year.
Daoud, what is this moment with Egypt's first democratically elected president on trial? What does it mean for you personally?
Well, of course, it means a failure. I mean, nobody wanted the experience to end it in such a terrible way. I mean, in Egypt, we've never had elected presidents in the first place. But at the same time, one of the major charges against Morsi is that he abused the rules of democracy to make it democracy only for once, and then you try to cancel all those rules. And he basically gave himself some dictatorial powers that even Mubarak wouldn't dare to put it on paper. So he divided the country. He gave the feeling to so many people that he was only a president for the Muslim Brotherhood members. So, of course, I think it's a very sad day because at the end of the, you know, calculation is that 3 years now have passed and the Egyptians have not seen any serious improvement in their lives, not just politically, but more important, economically, jobs, health, education. This is really what we made our revolution for 3 years ago.
What do you think is the future of democracy in Egypt right now?
I think that there are some forces, the young people who came out on January 25th will continue to insist that we don't want either a military state and we don't want a religious state such as the one that former President Morsi was trying to implement. And if those young people felt that their demands are not being met, I think they will go back to the streets again. But unfortunately, it seems that the hardliners from both sides, the Brotherhood and the military or the security, seem to have the upper hand right now. I hope that there was some wise people on both sides that would sit down and reach a compromise. But with the continuing escalation, this seems to be a far target so far.
Khaled Daoud is a spokesman for Egypt's liberal al-Dastur, or Constitution Party. He spoke with us from Cairo. When the economy tanks, keep your eyes on the metal fixtures around your house and neighborhood. Copper gutters, brass gates, even manhole covers, all fair game for thieves who can get good money for this stuff. Now, manhole covers, you may take them for granted when they're where they're supposed to be, but you'd surely notice if they weren't there, as in Colombia. John Otis has a story from Bogota.
Manhole covers are not the easiest things to steal. They weigh more than 300 pounds. Still, they're coveted by Colombian thieves because they're made with iron and can be melted down and sold. Scrap metal prices are rising, partly due to growing demand from China. So, in Bogota, there's been an outbreak of manhole cover robberies. Criminals use customized trucks with holes in the floor. They park over the manholes and pry off the tops, according to Jorge Izquierdo, a private investigator tracking the thefts.
Mafias organizadas
These are well-organized mafias, Izquierdo tells me. In just one day, he says, they can steal 30 manhole covers containing nearly a ton of iron. The missing lids force cars and trucks to swerve around manholes. Pedestrians have to beware, too. Luz Marina Rairan, who sells cleaning supplies, says her daughter stepped into one of these street craters and broke her leg. Last month, 2-year-old Diana Barrera was chasing pigeons in Bogota when she fell into an open manhole. Diana's mother told a TV news show that she jumped in after her, but the rushing water carried her daughter away. By the time police found her, Diana had drowned, washed about a mile through the city drainage system. Similar accidents have occurred across Latin America, Africa, and Asia. In Beijing, so many covers are being purloined that authorities have installed pedestrian safety nets in some manholes. To stymie thieves in Bogota, the city government is gradually replacing the metal covers with non-recyclable plastic ones made by a Bogota company called Materplast. On the factory floor, Materplast workers use power sanders to put the finishing touches on the plastic tops. They now plug about 20% of Bogota's 300,000 manholes. So, problem solved? Well, not exactly, says Gerardo Martinez, Materplast's commercial manager.
In 2011, ocurrió ya un primer problema.
2 years ago, Martinez says, thieves began stealing the plastic tops. In response, the company installed satellite tracking devices in dozens of its new covers. It discovered they were being resold to unsuspecting public works departments elsewhere in Colombia that wanted to shift to plastic covers. Recent news reports have focused more attention on the issue, but Martinez says the thefts will continue unless those responsible are caught and jailed, something that rarely happens in Colombia's overburdened legal system. By contrast, China is adopting a harder line. During a recent visit to Beijing, Martinez says Chinese officials told him that manhole cover thieves there could face the death penalty. For The World, I'm John Otis, Bogota, Colombia.
You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a Pacific island where they revere Britain's Prince Philip. Apparently, the cult started after he visited there with his uncle back in 1974.
They wore Hawaiian shirts, they swam in lagoons, they took part in rituals, they sat on plastic chairs with throne chalked on them, they rubbed noses with Tahitian lovelies.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, tonight at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Seems crazy now to think that Iran was once a key American ally. Washington and Tehran have had a hostile relationship for more than 3 decades. We are reminded of that today, the 34th anniversary of the 1979 storming of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and the start of the hostage crisis. But just a few years before that, in 1976, relations were still friendly enough to support lots of cultural exchanges. That's when Andy Warhol visited Iran. He was invited by the Iranian ambassador to the UN to do a portrait of Empress Farah Pahlavi. Writer Bob Colicello went with him.
We were greeted. We stepped off the Air Iran plane, and there were a dozen schoolgirls singing songs and showering us with rose petals. I mean, but Tehran then seemed quite modern, and it was a city that was booming. There was construction everywhere. We were taken to the Intercontinental Hotel, which was in the northern part of the city. The northern part of the city was the new part and the prosperous, affluent part of the city. A few days later, we went to the older part in the south. And while nothing, it didn't seem to be any really bad poverty like you would have found in those days, let's say, even in Mexico City, there was a marked contrast between north and south. But for the most part, the world we saw was very westernized, much more modern, I should say.
At some point, the portrait session happens. How did the original kind of idea for that portrait to be painted, to be commissioned, happen?
The Empress, for some background, she had studied architecture in Paris as a young woman, and she was very oriented towards the arts. She was responsible for the building of four or five museums in Tehran. Several of them were for the traditional arts, for ceramics, for Persian rugs. But she also personally oversaw the building of the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. So it was well known in the art world in New York and in Paris and London that she was actively collecting Western art, modern art, starting from the Impressionists right up through pop artists. And she actually built an extraordinary collection, probably spent under $100 million back then in the 70s. The collection is said to be worth $2.8 billion now.
Where is it today?
It's sitting in that museum in the vaults in the basement. The way the portrait of the Empress by Andy started was Andy was invited to a state dinner for the Shah of Iran given by President and Mrs. Ford. At that dinner, he had a brief conversation with her. In fact, he kind of, after dinner, was kind of avoiding her because he said that he was afraid she was going to ask him to dance. So he was running from the red room to the green room to the blue room. And she told me later all she wanted to do was talk to him some more.
How did that session go compared with other portrait sessions?
He could only take one person, so he took his manager, Fred Hughes. And when he got back to the hotel, I kept asking him, well, what was she like? What was the palace like? And he kept saying, oh, she's so great. Oh, the palace was so beautiful. She's so great. The palace was so beautiful. And I finally realized, as he said it in louder and louder tones, that he was afraid his hotel room was bugged. So he didn't want to say anything that could be taken the wrong way. But no, he liked her, and we had seen her a few times in New York, too, at some events.
Did Andy Warhol have any compunction about working for this monarch with that security apparatus? I mean, he talked about his concern about his hotel room being bugged. I mean, the Shah's catalog of abuses at that point as emperor were pretty well documented.
Andy was an artist first and foremost. His grasp of history and politics, I would say, it was not that great. Andy saw, big politicians, world leaders, as stars, just as he did athletes like Muhammad Ali and Jack Nicklaus, who he painted. We were criticized, Andy was criticized, I was, for dealing with the Shahs. The Village Voice newspaper, I remember, ran a front-page photograph of Andy and the Empress standing in front of her portrait, and the headline was, "The Beautiful Butchers." And the opening sentence was, "Torture tastes better with caviar."
Mm. Well, Bob, politics aside, what'd you think of the portrait in the end of the Empress, and where does it live now?
I thought it was one of Andy's more beautiful. He kind of captured a dreamy quality and a certain sadness in her eyes. The portraits, it's unclear how many he actually painted in the end. I always thought there were about 14, and somewhere from 6 to 8 went to the Empress herself. She's even unclear of how many are still in the museum. A couple of them can be seen actually at a restaurant in New York called Casa Lever.
Mm.
So the Empress is there hanging with Dolly Parton and Dennis Hopper and Alfred Hitchcock. And it's quite a wall of paintings, actually.
Bob Colicello, longtime Vanity Fair contributor and Andy Warhol's biographer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Iran, homosexuality is illegal and punishable by death, yet it's legal to get a sex change. True. A fatwa dating back to the 1960s allowed sexual reassignment surgery. But transgender people are far from equals in Iran. They get kicked out of school, get arrested, and are rarely able to find work. Many turn to prostitution to survive, or they flee to neighboring Turkey in hopes of resettling as refugees. But as Shuka Kalantari reports, fleeing life in Iran offers little solace.
Aynaz is dancing by herself in an upscale club in Ankara, Turkey's capital city. She has long, wavy black hair, big hazel eyes, dark eyeliner, and full fuchsia-colored lips. She's really pretty, and so the empty dance floor quickly fills up with Turkish businessmen trying to catch her attention. Chances are, those businessmen don't know that Aynaz is a transgender refugee, and that 10 months ago, she was working as a prostitute in Iran. She says transgender women in Iran are treated almost as subhuman, and it's why she fled.
I left Iran because someone strangled and killed one of my transgender friends in her home, and my other friend was killed by her brother, who was a drug addict.
Aynaz grew up in a small town where she was harassed and frequently arrested. As a little boy, her crime was acting too feminine. By the age of 15, she was expelled from school. So at the advice of a therapist, Aynaz got a full sex change. She thought that would make her life easier. Because while being gay can lead to the death penalty in Iran, sex changes are totally legal. But things only got worse. She was forced to leave her home and move to Tehran. Aynaz says she soon took the path most of her transgender friends did. Prostitution.
We weren't in the position to get jobs. It wasn't possible. We did not have the education, and no one would have hired us anyway. So we would find men that wanted sex, and that was because we needed money, not because we wanted to.
So Aynaz bought a one-way ticket to Ankara, and she applied for asylum with the United Nations. Her goal was resettling to the U.S. or Canada, but that process can take up to 3 years, and she quickly ran out of money. Life as a refugee is tough for anyone. Life as a transgender refugee is even harder. Turkey is almost as conservative as Iran, and the same prejudices persist. Veysel Esiz is with Helsinki Citizens Assembly, a refugee advocacy group in Istanbul. He says neither the Turkish government nor the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, provides any substantial assistance to any refugees. So people are pretty much on their own.
You have to rely on yourself for arranging your accommodation, for covering your health costs, or to find a job. And getting a work permit is possible in theory, but impossible in practice. So it is the lack of financial support that leads these people to pursue sex work.
While most refugees can find under-the-table jobs here and there to make ends meet, transgender refugees are out of luck. At a dinner party in Ankara, Aynaz is drinking wine and chatting with some refugees she befriended. She says she's lucky to have met a few Iranians who accept her, because for the most part, it's other Iranian refugees who harass her the most.
Iranians in Turkey are worse to us than Turkish people. If Iranians find out, they quickly start talking behind your back.
Or they out you as a transgender person to prospective employers so they can get your job. And no work means no money. Aynaz says after 2 months in Turkey, she was kicked out of her apartment for not paying rent. So she packed her small suitcase and went to a local nightclub. She sat down, ordered a beer, and started to cry. That's when a Turkish man sat down next to her and told her she could live with him for a while, but with one caveat.
He always wanted sex, and sometimes he'd force me. I told the UNHCR, and they asked if I wanted to take him to court. I told them that I couldn't, because even though he was taking advantage of me, he never threw me out of the house and didn't leave me homeless. UNHCR isn't going to give me a room to sleep in.
Aynaz says she hates the guy, but she's still dating him, because he now pays her rent. She says putting up with him is better than being on a street corner. But Aynaz recently got a ray of hope. She received a letter from UNHCR saying she's been accepted as a refugee in Vancouver, Canada. There she'll get enough government support to go back to school and eventually get a real job, which is all she ever wanted in Iran.
If we had a government that defended us, that let us study, that let us get a degree and didn't bother us, then I would have become an educated person and my life would have been different. But they didn't let us study. They didn't let us do well.
Aynaz says she plans to take English classes in Vancouver
and eventually wants to start her own beauty salon. She says the idea of starting this new life in Canada helps her deal with the fact that life in Turkey ended up being a lot like life in Iran. For the World, I'm Shuka Kalantari in Ankara, Turkey.
Shuka's story was made possible by a reporting fellowship from the International Center for Journalists in Washington. Let's turn the corner now for a story about royalty. Some members of Britain's royal family are very popular around the globe. Queen Elizabeth, for one. Also the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, a.k.a. William and Kate. But Prince Philip? You wouldn't think the Queen's stern-looking husband would have his own cult, would you? Well, he does, in Vanuatu in the South Pacific, specifically on the island of Tanna, where some 1,500 Philip devotees live. British writer Matthew Bayliss traveled to Tanna to meet them, and he's written a book about the cult. He says the islander's fascination with the Duke of Edinburgh started more than 40 years ago.
Well, I think it probably has something to do with his two visits to the area, particularly the first one. He came in 1974, and he was without his wife, the Queen. He was with his uncle, Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was something of a father figure to the Prince, and they had a jolly old time. They wore Hawaiian shirts, they swam in lagoons, they took part in rituals, they sat on plastic chairs with throne chalked on them, they rubbed noses with Tahitian lovelies. In general, they sort of showed themselves to be very, very different from the colonial officials of which the people of that area had had the most experience. They showed themselves to be easygoing, rough and ready, all-action guys, and that's exactly the kind of man who they most admire in that part of the South Pacific.
And that's all it took for a Prince Philip cult to emerge.
I'm not sure that that's all it took, no. But I think at the same time, there was a lot of turmoil in that particular area. They were preparing for independence. And people were casting round for allies. And the village that specifically ended up supporting Prince Philip is kind of off the trail, really. It's called Yaknanan Village, and it's on a mountain ridge, and kind of felt that they needed a symbolic and significant relationship with some sort of outside power in order to help them. So at the same time as Prince Philip was there, sort of being a rough and ready all-action guy, these people were thinking, we need to find someone who can be a patron and a figurehead for us.
Did they idolize any other figures from this period? I mean, did they actually have kind of like an audition? Like, who are we going to choose as our idol?
No. But they do, as a whole, view foreign visitors in a very sort of significant way. For instance, on the island of New Hanover, which is part of Papua New Guinea, in the 1960s, the islanders invited one of your former presidents, Mr. Lyndon Johnson, to come and represent them in their House of Parliament. The reasoning behind it was quite deliberate slap in the face to the Australian authorities who were ruling the area quite badly.
So what does this look like visually? Have they carved idols of Prince Philip?
For a very long time, Philippism, as I call it in my book, was a very quiet sort of pietistic faith. In fact, on Tanna, it really is much more about what they would say, tok tok mo tink tink, talking and thinking. But recently, sort of since about 2009, when the last chief died and the new one took over, you know, they have a ceremony and they've built a little shrine and that kind of stuff.
Prince Philip, though, Matthew, I mean, he's not exactly the most lovable of the royal family. He's uttered some pretty racially charged comments in the past. Do the good people of Tanna Vanuatu know about this side of him?
Oh, yes, they do. And they have a perfect explanation for it. You know, when I was there, I sort of said, well, you know, he's not tremendously sort of popular in Britain. They said, yes, exactly. That's because he's from Tanna.
Does the prince know how they feel about him down in Tanna?
Oh, he certainly does. I mean, back in 1978, as Britain was really preparing to leave the area for good, they received a message from the British residency out there saying, you know, could you please make some sort of gesture to these people on this village. And they sent a signed photograph. And I think three or four signed photographs have been sent since then, along with a number of letters. So, yes, Philip certainly knows about it.
Matthew Bayliss, the author of the new book, Man Belong, Mrs. Queen, My South Sea Adventures with the Philip Worshippers. Matthew Bayliss, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead on the show, if a band leader is a court judge, shouldn't it be easier to tour on the world from PRI?
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Over the weekend in Germany, news broke about an enormous trove of modernist paintings found in an apartment in Munich. Police apparently first discovered the paintings 2 years ago, all crammed in a darkened room between canned food and empty juice cartons. The 1,500 pieces include works by Picasso, Matisse, and Chagall, masterpieces thought to have been lost or looted during World War II. Gwendolyn Webster is an art historian in Aachen, Germany. She's anxiously waiting to find out more.
Very little has been revealed of the artworks on show, but it is obviously from the modern period, from the 20th century, expressionists, cubists, certainly the cream of early 20th century art anyway.
So the German magazine that broke the story over the weekend said the artworks were found by chance when tax authorities investigated the reclusive son of a late and once, I guess, pretty well-known art dealer named Hildebrandt Gurlitt in Munich.
Who was
Gurlitt?
It's a very strange story. Gurlitt was actually 1/8 Jewish. He was a museum director in the town of Zwickau in the very east of Germany. For his museum, he collected contemporary art of the time, particularly the expressionists. Gurlitt moved to Hamburg, and it seems to have been his expertise that attracted the Nazis to him. And he was asked to investigate artworks that would be suitable for Hitler's personal collection in Linz, the so-called Führermuseum. So he was very much involved in the wheelings and dealings of the art world under the Nazis. And after the war, he managed to escape because he claimed he'd been a victim of the Nazis. And so they let him off.
So you call this progressive art, but I gather at least 300 paintings in the collection are thought to belong to a body of about 16,000 works once declared degenerate art.
Now, what the Nazis described as degenerate art was a very sort of arbitrary thing altogether. For instance, the works of Nolde were described as degenerate, and Nolde was a member of the Nazi Party and objected to this very strongly. So degenerate was really, some of it was Jewish, some of it wasn't. But this degenerate art, whatever it was they didn't like, was displayed in Germany from 1933 onwards in a series of exhibitions. Some of it was then taken out and burnt. Some of it, though, was sold off to private collectors. This is really an enormous number of works that everybody expected had been thrown into the flames, 300 works, that have obviously been rescued for whatever reason by Gurlitt.
If this art was about to be burned, is Gurlitt kind of the savior of these works?
I would hesitate to call him a savior, but it may well be that he rescued works of art that were destined for the bonfires, either to sell them off to private dealers or for his own collection.
What happens with this art now?
That's a very good question. You've got to decide who owns it. And there's going to be claims of restitution. This is a huge can of worms. And I think that's why the discovery of this hoard of paintings was covered up.
When you first heard the story, Gwendolyn, knowing all that you know about that era and Nazis looting art, what question did you really first want answered?
I'm dying to see what these works were, who they were by, and where they came from. My second reaction was perhaps a more measured one. It is that we always ought to warn against the dangers of fascism. I've talked to collectors in Germany here who lost everything under the Nazis and see pictures in museums in New York or London that they know are theirs and have no way of proving it. And the appalling crimes that were committed under fascism, it could never be righting these wrongs, really, however much money there is or restitution.
Gwendolyn Webster, art historian in Aachen, Germany. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Theft is the kind of thing our next guest rules on from his bench as a court judge in the West African nation of Niger. But here's the thing about Judge Issoufou Moumin. Judge is his day job. At night, he goes by the stage name Almeida. He fronts the band Tal National. You may not have heard of them, but they're one of the most popular bands in Niger. That, and being a judge, well, you'd think that'd streamline the process for Almeida to get a visa to tour the U.S. Not so.
The visa was a problem because of the problem of security. Sometimes there's a reason of security. The ambassade can close for weeks.
Can't a judge influence things in diplomatic circles? That means you're a VIP.
Yes, maybe. Maybe
But a judge has to take security seriously, and Almeida is not the only musician in Tal Nacional. He's got at least 9 bandmates he's got to get through the visa process as well. Tal Nacional is a diverse band. 8 different ethnic groups are represented, like the Hausa, Zarma, and Tuareg. Almeida says that's why the band is called Tal Nacional, or Tal National. The face of Niger is represented in the band, and the musicians become as one, a musical e pluribus unum. Almeida is the undisputed leader of Tal Nacional, but there's another leader who plays a role on the band's latest CD, the second president of Niger, Seni Kounche. The late president came to power in a military coup in 1974, but Almeida says he was a good coup maker.
Kounche built Niger. Kounche refused to allow the people take money for the take the government money, the country money.
So he fought corruption.
Yes, he fought against corruption.
What could African leaders, what could the president of Niger today learn from Seni Kounche?
Kounche don't think about himself. He think about country. The political people today in Africa, not in Niger only, they are taken just by themselves.
We'll let Tal Nacional sing their praises to the former president in this tune called Kounche from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Please join us again tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.